Hello and welcome to the Recovering from Religion podcast. Our mission here is to offer hope, healing, and support to those struggling with issues of doubt and non-belief. What follows is the audio from selected videos posted on Recovering from Religion's YouTube channel. So sit back, relax, and enjoy.
So Daniela Sousa, if you haven't been here in the previous one, she's a PhD, and she helps moms grapple with what it means to make a person, which is not a small topic. She's a philosophical coach and co-creator and co-host of Think Hard podcast, which brings philosophy to the real world. She has a PhD in philosophy and a graduate certificate in women's studies from Temple University and a certification in philosophical coaching, counseling from the American Philosophical Practitioners Association. So when her daughter was born, she almost broke her brain trying to figure out what the hell happened. And now she helps other moms make sense of motherhood. So welcome, Danielle. Thank you so much for being here with us today.
Thank you so much for having me back. I'm really delighted to be here. I had a great time last time.
Great, 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 great. It's good that you didn't refuse the second time we had. And especially with this topic that's hope in a godless world, which is today's theme, which I think a lot of us can relate to. Regardless if you have been religious or not, I know I have struggled with it. And now that we are in a global pandemic, it's probably more relevant than ever. So how will you start the discussion on that, Danielle? What is the first thing to approach?
Well, if you don't mind, you want me to pop up the poll, like the answers that folks had?
Sure. Oh, yeah, sure.
Okay. All right. Let's share the results here so we can see that we've got. So the question is, on a scale of 1 to 5, how hopeful are you about the general state of the world right now? 1 is, oh, it's hopeless. And 5 is, it's full of rainbows and unicorns and sunshine. So we had answers. 12% of the attendees thought it was hopeless. 35% of the attendees were number 2. They're like, hey, it's somewhat hopeless. 29% were neutral about it. It's neither hopeless or incredibly hopeful. And 18% thought it was somewhat hopeful, and the remainder 6% was like, life is fantastic. Me, if I were to vote this, I'd probably put it close to a 1 or a 2, maybe more towards the 2 side. The world seems so crazy, and me as an individual, how could I possibly have an impact on it? So and I'm also prone naturally to being kind of depressed times too. So I don't know. That's kind of where I stand.
Yeah. I mean, fair, right? Like the state of the world right now is overwhelming, I think, for a lot of people. I'm actually right now in Portland, Oregon, which is all over the headlines.
This is where our president deployed federal troops to tear gas and stop the protesters. Like, they were all dressed in military garb. That is very frightening.
Yes.
And you're in ground zero.
I am here. This is my city. I know people, you know, who are organizing and out there on the front lines. So it's an intense time right now. And I want to say that, you know, I was remembering back to when I first started thinking and writing and speaking about hope. It's kind of been like a little bit of an intellectual hobby horse for me for the last few years. But I remember I actually first started writing about it when I was invited to give the graduation commencement speech for a college hybrid place that I was teaching in New York City. And I said to the students in my commencement address, you know, the world needs critical thinkers, right? I'm a philosopher. I teach people how to think. I teach people how to be aware and to question the powers that be and to, you know, question beliefs and to kind of reconstruct those things. And the world needs critical thinkers. And I desperately believe that. But I think what the world also needs is hopeful people. And I think it needs hopeful critical thinkers specifically. And I think that is really, really important for thinking about education and for thinking about our place in the world. And I think that hope is particularly tricky for people who have left or lost their faith, because for a lot of people, hope is so bound up with the religious faith, you know, and religious ideas, that even if this world is terrible and, you know, you have experienced great trauma or loss or tragedy, the idea is that, well, there'll be divine justice or another life or somehow, some way, it's all going to like even out and come back to you. And so you can take heart in that. And I think for people who lose that kind of that overarching sort of order to the universe,
I completely can relate to that, because when I was religious, I felt like, well, just like you said, there is this great equalizer in the sky. The folks who are doing wrong now will have their comeuppance in, that's probably the wrong word, the absolute wrong word. They'll have their, they'll get it back, you know, at the gates of heaven or gates of hell or whatever. But more and more, as I was coming out of religion, I was seeing people who were getting away with crap and heinous crimes, and they were fine. They were fine afterward. They lived fine lives and walked away from any kind of consequences or punishment. And it was like, it's up to us to do this. How are we?
Right. So there's that whole moral question, right, about like where's the justice? And then there's also the sort of like, even if it's not other people doing wrong per se, but it's like, you know, there's an accident, there's a flood, there's a fire, there's an unexplained death, and it seems to have no purpose and no meaning and no reason, and that can feel very chaotic. And when you don't have a sense of meaning, it's hard to have a sense of hope, I think.
Yeah. And I find that I've been coping with the balance of bad news and good news not very well. To me, I've seen more and more bad news. There was a time where there was this YouTube channel that was putting out some amazing good news, and they've since stopped. And I'm needing to find some sort of balance to cope better with this, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that, I mean, I guess I just want to start by saying here that, like, I am not under any delusion that, like, that the world is sort of terrible right now, like more so than usual, I think, for many people. And I don't think that the answer is necessarily it can be helpful to like try and find the good stuff and focus on that. But I actually want to talk about like a version of hope that I think is able to acknowledge and recognize and really sit with how bad things are without needing to.
Oh my gosh, that would be amazing. Yeah, that would be great. I would, can you just like email that version of hope to me? I'd really appreciate it.
Well, I'm hoping that we'll be able to talk about it today, and then I can like offer a version to you that feels, because otherwise what's it for, right? If it's just like, oh, it's not so bad. Here, look at this puppy. Like, that's nice for a while, right? That's nice as long as you can look at the puppy, but then also there is still all this terrible stuff happening. So I want to talk about a version of hope that takes seriously all of the terrible stuff and doesn't minimize it and doesn't try and explain it away, and yet nevertheless we're able to find some reason to hope. So I think the first thing to do is, one thing that I have found very helpful in this is talking a little bit about the difference between hope and optimism. And I am a philosopher. This last time, like the first thing we always do is like talk about definitions. Like what exactly are we talking about here?
Okay.
I think it's really helpful. And this one will help sort of define the kind of hope that I'm talking about. Now this, these two definitions that I'm working from, this conceptual framework comes from philosopher Cornel West. And he has written about anti-Black racism and social justice for many, many years. And this schema, he actually talks about, he was interviewed in the wake of the LA uprising or riots, whatever you want to call them, in 1992, after the acquittal of the officers who brutally assaulted Rodney King.
I remember that distinctly. I was in Pasadena at the time, right near the where it all started.
Oh, you were like right there.
Yeah.
Wow.
It was scary.
Yeah, I can imagine. I can imagine. And
I wasn't even in high school yet. I was a kid.
Yeah. Yeah,
as
I was.
As I may look, I'm not that old.
It's just that beard gives you gravitas.
Yeah, I know. It's a great I got gray after the Rodney King incident. So.
Yeah, so Cornel West was interviewed in sort of the wake of these riots, and so he was talking about how people just were despairing, right? Like what we're seeing now is certainly rivals that, but that was really devastating. I mean, like whole portions of South Central Los Angeles were like literally burnt to the ground. And people, you know, there were like 60 some people killed, thousands were injured. It was like, you know, intense. And it erupted in this neighborhood that had so long been suffering from racial tensions and poverty and oppression in so many different ways. And it just felt so full of despair to the people who were there. And so West is talking about this and he says, you know, I think a lot of people just, they fall into this despair, but the thing is, that's where you have to begin. Despair is not where you end, it's where you begin. And you respond to despair with hope and not with optimism. And he says the difference is this, that optimism is kind of like, it is a way of trying to cobble together evidence, like enough data to make a case that things are not as bad as we think they are. Like that things are improving.
So just to back up slightly, you had said we need to start a despair. This is very similar to your talk about creating meaning for your life, too. This seems very similar just at the starting point.
It is, right? Because it's like, look, you got to go through the valley to come out the other side. And I think that if you're not despairing, then you're not paying attention. I just think that you're not really being compassionate to what is happening in the world if you don't feel some level of despair somewhere at some point, because the world, and particularly this world in this moment right now, is really bad. Like there are lots of people suffering a lot and there are lots of injustices. And I think if you don't recognize that and feel that, then you're missing something important.
When you say that gathering evidence is not the way, so let me put you an example, because me personally, the way I try to get hope when I'm feeling a bit lost is that I try to compare like the amount of suffering that we have right now in this century compared to like a few centuries ago when we couldn't vote and, you know, there was a lot more issues back there that right now we have kind of conquered. Is that part of the things that we are not supposed to do? Is that optimism or could that be hope?
Well, and I don't think it's necessarily that you're not supposed to do it. It's just a different way of responding, right? Mm-hmm. And it's not exactly the way that West responds and that I'm going to offer today. But I don't think it's necessarily like you're not supposed to do it. I just think that it's like, it is a... it's a very rational kind of response, right? It's a rational, like highly rational, highly secular kind of, let's just maybe compare to like, at least our suffering is not as bad as it used to be, right? Or look at all of these reasons why we might improve and look at these technological advances and look at these nonprofits and look at these people and look at this like good news network that is like sharing like humanity being good to each other. And those are all wonderful things to turn to and wonderful things to kind of buoy your spirits. But I think that sometimes they don't work. Like they just, it just feels like it doesn't matter how many like cute puppies I look at, the world feels like it's still just on fire right now.
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, not trying to say that we live in a utopia in which everything is fine. I mean, we are literally in a pandemic, like racial injustices are still a massive, massive thing all over around the world. So yeah, I guess that makes sense. I guess it's just like each person has to decide also where they get it from and how kind of their brain works. So I'm like to think that I'm quite rational. Probably not as much as I think, but I do try to find like hope in those things. But I appreciate that maybe other people wouldn't, and that it may give you the impression, the deluded impression, that there is more good things in the world than what you may try to get from like rationalizing an issue that you can't really rationalize, really, because it's too complex and there's too many factors and too many things really going wrong in the planet.
Yeah, and I think that like that kind of like getting perspective, like shifting your perspective on things is a really good skill. Like that is a really good and important and like and effective sort of coping skill and emotional regulation skill. And if you can do it, great, like use it. Sometimes it just doesn't feel super effective, I think. Mm-hmm. And this is, let's just say, like an additional way of thinking about how to see the suffering as real, to experience it as just as bad and dramatic as we feel it is. Mm-hmm. And because I think sometimes what happens when we compare it, it's like, well, it's not that bad. We're trying to minimize it, right? This version is like, no, it's bad. It's like real bad. And like, we're not going to try and minimize it at all. It's actually that bad. And we're going to hope anyway.
What you're saying is that Dr. West's definition of optimism in some sense minimizes the suffering that is going on. It doesn't necessarily bring it or allow it to us to fully experience it. Is that kind of what you're saying?
I think it can have that effect sometimes. Okay. I don't think that necessarily always is what happens, but I think it can sometimes have that effect that we try and... we try and reason it away and convince ourselves it's not that bad. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it is that bad.
So what would be his definition of hope then? If optimism is kind of the idea of gathering evidence that the world is getting better or the situation is getting better, like for me personally, I'm very excited about the new Black Lives Matter surge. And so I'm seeing like the statues are coming down, cities and states are starting to take notice. Like this is evidence for me, like, oh, I can now be optimistic that things are going to be better. Right. What would be the hope side of that?
So the hope, Dr. West's version of hope it's sort of an existential version of hope. That's sort of the way I see it. And in a way, it's, he himself is a Christian philosopher. And in a way, it almost feels a bit like faith, but I think there is a way of thinking about it that really speaks to more of the human spirit than any sort of supernatural deity. He said, look, we need to... Hope is going beyond the evidence. It's transcending the evidence to imagine new possibilities, to come up with unseen solutions, to believe that those solutions are possible with no guarantees, just that this like hard faith in a way that like things are, that world is possible. And we're going to believe in it through an act of will, not because there's evidence to support it. In fact, even when the evidence is against it, we are going to believe that that world is possible and we are going to move toward that world anyway.
Mm-hmm. That makes perfect sense, because I guess the issue with the optimism we're saying before is that let's imagine that objectively we have more suffering. There is a nuclear world, everything goes to shit, and we have like a massive amount of suffering. Then the optimism version wouldn't last anymore because right. There's no, like the evidence doesn't support being hopeful for the future. Okay. Right. Yeah, that makes sense.
Exactly. It's just like, well, you know, now look at, but the other thing too, is that the world, like you can, depending on what story you're telling, you're going to be able to find evidence for it, right? Like this is the thing that we discover is everyone has a confirmation bias. You only listen to the evidence that supports your narrative. And so you're going to find evidence to support it. And if the narrative is the world is terrible, you'll find evidence to support that. If the narrative is, you know, well, people are good, you'll find evidence to support that. But this is a way of saying, look, even if the evidence is terrible, regardless of what the evidence is, whether it's good or bad or pointing this way or that, you believe that the world's going to get better, full stop. And you just commit to that, right? And so in that sense, hope is not a mood. It's not a feeling. It's a decision. You decide to hope.
It sounds like optimism is a conclusion and hope is a choice.
Yeah, I think you could frame it that way. Yeah, right?
You know what? Damn it. I mean, I'm getting excited now because, like, I can see that I can choose to hope. I can, and that gives me the power. That gives me the, I don't have to, it doesn't, like you said, it doesn't have to rely on evidence, but it's something that is like us as humans can individually choose to do. And that feels very powerful too. If we can, don't have to worry about the evidence, that on the skeptical side of me is like, I don't like that. I need the evidence, but the old-fashioned humanity side of me is like, yes, there's power in making the choice to hope.
Yeah, and I think that you have to pay attention to evidence when you are assessing the problem and coming up with solutions and doing the work, right? Like the evidence is important for the actual work on the ground. You need to listen to people. You need to see what the problem is. You need to come up with solutions based on the evidence. But I think that the decision to believe that you can act in a way to improve the world doesn't require anything. It doesn't require any evidence at all. I mean, Angela Davis says you have to act as if you can radically change the world, and you have to do it all the time.
So in some sense, I could start with hope, work towards finding a solution that will based on evidence and based on trial and error, find that solution. And then optimism can come from that.
Yeah, right. Like, so as you start to do the work, right, and then you start to create change, then, oh, look, there's some evidence of improvement that I've just helped create. Look, now aren't things getting better? And then that sort of rational, secular version of evidence can come along with it. But I do think that, I mean, hope is it's not a sufficient condition for change, but I think it's a necessary condition for change.
It sure is a driving condition, that's for sure, because hope is incredibly motivating to me. Like, if I didn't have hope that what we're doing here at Recovering from Religion is making a difference, then fuck it. I'm taking my time and effort somewhere else.
Yeah. And I think that it is incredibly motivating, but a lot of people are waiting to be motivated by the evidence, right? Like we're like, oh, everything's terrible. I'm in despair. Convince me that it's going to get better. And if you can't, then I'm just going to stay here in my hole.
We have a comment in the chat saying that hope is a condition for entrepreneurship. And I've started several businesses and I can absolutely agree with that, that hope that is, we have a vision, we have a goal to get to. And then the closer we work, the more and more that we build it, the more and more optimistic we become that'll succeed. And I'm really grateful that you kind of took the time to separate this out, because I definitely had the two conflated. And I now realize I can have hope without having optimism at first. And it kind of reminds me a little bit about the movie of Rogue One, where they just are going to go into the jaws of the beast and do their thing. They all just kind of hoped it would work out because it needed to be done. But I'm going to cut this part out because it's dumb. Like what I just said, it's totally dumb, but
don't you dare cut
carry
this
on.
Out. I will add a comment with the transcript if you
anyways.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think it is helpful to think about this hope as an act of will. And I think part of the reason some people don't do it is because they don't want to be taken as like a sucker, right? Like there's some sense that like seeing the world and being negative about it is like having some sort of wisdom that, like, as I said, if you're not despairing, you're not paying attention, or it's just like, well, I'm despairing, so that means that I'm paying attention. And like, my despair is my way of showing that I care.
Yeah. Right? And on the flip side, hope for some folks seem like naive and being a naive person. Like you haven't seen what it really is like out there. And so how can you possibly right. have hope? And again, it's kind of pointing towards, look at the evidence. You shouldn't be optimistic.
Right, exactly. And so we don't want to be considered like simple, and we don't want to be considered delusional or immature or somehow, you know, Pollyannas. But I think that this kind of hope, the hope that comes from seeing how bad things are and having the will and the courage to believe in a better world anyway, takes an incredible amount of strength and tenacity and wisdom.
Yeah, I was going to say, it must be also really exhausting, because if you have like a project or something, I mean, I'm just making it more simple than what it is, but you want to reduce suffering in a specific area, and you keep trying and you keep trying and it's not working out, having that hope is just so, like, it takes your energy away completely. Like, I know I feel that way with certain things. So if this is something that you have to implement for all the aspects of social justice issues and just overall suffering, it must be really, really exhausting. Is there any way we can deal with being like kind of burnt out in that sense? Because it must be easy to lose the hope then, because it is a choice, but then how can we make sure that we don't make the other choice of saying, this is too hard for me?
So I have a few thoughts. One is that I think hope, the kind of hope I'm talking about, this kind of hope is a decision. We might also say that this kind of hope is a virtue, which I know can be a word that may bristle some folks, given the background of many people on this call. But by virtue, I just mean it in a very philosophical way, in the sense of it is a kind of, it is a quality to which we aspire, mm-hmm. and to which we try and act, knowing that we may fall short, but that we kind of hold as a guiding principle. And I also mean something very specific that comes from ancient philosopher Aristotle. Aristotle, when he talks about virtue, he says that virtue is something that is, one, you get by doing. So you become courageous by doing courageous acts, just the same way like a builder is a builder by building, and a writer is a writer by writing. A courageous person is courageous by doing courageous things. An honest person is is honest by doing honest things. And a hopeful person is hopeful by virtue of doing hopeful things, right? Mm-hmm. So I think it is action driven, and I think it is something that has to be done over time. That's another feature of Aristotle's definition of virtue. It's something that becomes a habit. Mm-hmm. We do it continuously, and we build it as a habit. So we become courageous by doing courageous things, not just one courageous thing one time, but by making a habit of doing courageous things.
Like a muscle, kind of.
Yes, right? And okay. We build it.
It sounds a little bit like fake it till you make it type of mentality.
I mean, it can be, in the sense of you may not feel it. And I think that's the thing. It's not a feeling, right? Like, you don't feel honest necessarily. I mean, maybe you do, but we don't think about honesty as like a feeling that you have. Okay. It's just like it's a quality that you have by like doing honest things. In the same way, I think we need to think about hope, not in terms of a feeling that we have, but as a quality that we are cultivating.
Yeah, so it can't just be lost suddenly, because it's within you, and it's something that you have worked on, and it's a striving to be permanent or at least long-lasting somehow. Okay, yeah, that makes sense.
It's something you have to come back to again and again, and it is exhausting, because it's like it is a will. I mean, and the existentialists talk about this, like you have to reassert your decision to hope again and again and again in the face of the evidence that may not be the wind at your back. Mm-hmm. Eric, what do you think of this? You're looking.
I like what you're saying. I have assigned a specific feeling that I get to hope, though. But what you're saying actually makes more sense, because I think if I break down this feeling that I get, that I've assigned to hope, there is an excitement there tied to a vision, I think, like a mental idea of what is possible, what could be better. So maybe I need to sort of pull that word hope away from that feeling and just kind of identify it as being excited. And there's also a feeling of peacefulness too, that I've attached to the hope. If I can see the hope more of as a muscle, as a virtual, as a skill that I'm working on, that could make sense. Okay. So yeah, that was kind of what was going through my head. It's like, but I have this feeling of hope. Everybody says, this hopeful feeling.
Yeah. And I think that's the way we typically talk about it, right? Like that's usually how we use that word. But I think that what happens is that we see our capacity to act kind of then be at the mercy of our emotional state at the moment, right? Like this is a way of disentangling that feeling that you get from the decision you've made to act toward a goal, right? The action toward the goal is the hopeful action. You can be angry or sad or depressed or, you know, whatever while you're doing it and still do the hopeful action.
Okay. Okay.
Right? You may not do it as effectively, right? You may, there may be good reason to kind of be centered and, you know, elevated, right? Optimistic in that other sense, right? To do it effectively, but I don't think it's a requirement for hope, you know?
I like that then, because if I am feeling depressed or I'm feeling down or feeling sad, I don't have to say that I've lost hope in that sense. I can, because I no longer have that feeling.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and it's a way of saying like, here's the mission. Here's the work, here's the vision, here's the thing I'm going to keep moving towards, even though I feel like crap today, even though it seems like we've just suffered a huge setback or the world is overwhelming or whatever. You're pulling those things apart and you can still maintain hope and say that you are still hopeful in spite of feeling bad for this moment.
All right.
So what are specific decisions that you can make during your average day, you know, bringing it to like a normal day? Amaya wakes up the next day. I want to be hopeful. I want to make that choice. How? You know, if I'm feeling like terrible, how do I transform that and say, this is going to be a decision? What should I do?
Well, yeah. So I'm looking a little bit in the chat here. People are talking about like meaning, right? And like how meaning kind of works its way into all this. I mean, I think it depends on what your typical self-talk is throughout the day, that, you know, there might be something there to work with about the world or whatever it may be. I think part of it is understanding. The other thing here is understanding if hope is connected to action, mm-hmm. and hope is a habit that is done through action continuously, then part of maintaining that hope, that hope as a virtue, is sort of decreasing your sphere of concern into a sphere of actionable influence there, right? Like, okay. you may need to understand that the work that you are doing is just like a little drop in the bucket, right? Like, and I think that's the thing that people feel very hopeless about. It's like, I've got to move this mountain over there and I've got a pair of tweezers and I'm doing it just one little grain of sand at a time. And it feels like the job is so big and I am so small and I don't know how it's ever going to happen. And I think that part of it is understanding what's possible for humans, for individual humans. Like, part of it is this feeling of like wanting to be more powerful than we are, wanting to have greater impact and influence than one person can ever have. And so it's understanding a human life is only so long, and we only have so much power given where we are, and we need to work within the bounds of that. Mm-hmm. And it's also understanding the power of collective action, right? That I am but one person, and so are all of my neighbors. And when we come together, we can move the mountain a little faster. And understanding what your role is in creating collective action and in facilitating and doing your job within that collective action. So I think part of it is about scale, right? The other thing is, it's understanding that even if you spend your whole life moving one grain of sand from here to there, the wind may come and blow it back the other direction as soon as you stop, right? Like, there are no guarantees here, right? Go ahead, Eric.
I think that was one of the toughest things for me to overcome coming out of religion was thinking that there was this great equalizer, and then realizing it's a fantasy, that it's us. There isn't, in my view, there isn't karma. There isn't a book of judgment. That it's up to us to make the difference, to make it better or make it worse, or mold the world to how we want it to be. And that was very, very tough to give up. And it was depressing at times too, to realize there was nobody's going to equalize this unless we do it. It's not like a natural law that you do one thing bad and you're going to get one thing good in return. Mm-hmm. That's what I meant, or that's kind of where I was going with, or thinking about when you were talking about there's no guarantees in life, because you're absolutely right. And that was a very difficult lesson for me to learn. Just mentally was a difficult lesson.
It is, because we like guarantees and we like seeing the fruits of our labor, and we like having impact on the world. And I think it is really challenging to put all of your time and energy into something and still feel like you're not moving the needle on it. And here's my thought about that. I often refer to, I think we mentioned this the last time I was on, The Myth of Sisyphus by Albert Camus, which is a really wonderful essay. And he uses the Greek story of Sisyphus, who was punished by the gods, I don't know, for sleeping with one of Zeus's girlfriends or something. But he's punished by the gods. And his punishment is that he has to roll a boulder up a mountain until it almost reaches the top, and then it rolls all the way back down. And then he goes back down and he does it again, and he just does that for all eternity, right? And I think a lot of times when we are thinking about our way in the world and we're thinking about hope, and like this task that we're trying to do, we feel like Sisyphus. We are just like, it is pointless. Like, we're going to move this grain of sand over here, and then the wind's going to come and blow it all away. And it feels so, it feels hopeless, right? It feels overwhelming. It feels like, why am I even doing this? What's the point? What's the meaning in all of it?
Yeah. If I was in Sisyphus's shoes and I had to roll this boulder up every day, day in, day out, and do this exact same thing, I would think, what's the point here? What is my end goal? This is hopeless. This is depressing. And, but I can't change it. How did Camus kind of flip that around, or did he? Yeah.
No, he does. And he actually, his question is, what is Sisyphus thinking on his walk back down the mountain, right? The boulder has gone down. He's walking back down. He's just like, well, here we, like that time also didn't work. What is he thinking about at this point?
I know, it's CrossFit. That's what he's thinking, right?
I mean, in a weird way, you might be actually kind of beyond the answer.
I did not expect that at all.
He's just flipping this giant tire end over end all the way up the mountain, and then it rolls down every day.
I mean, kind of, because Camille asked, like, okay, so when he gets to the bottom of the mountain, why doesn't he just stop?
Yeah.
Like, just sit down. Like, don't do that anymore. Don't do it. Like, there's not, like, you know, demons whipping him. It's just like, you just, I mean, maybe, I don't know the full story, but he could make the decision to not do it, right? And Camus's like, okay, so if he decided not to do it, well, then what? He just sits in a barren tundra for the rest of eternity. There's a big boulder next to him. That's it.
Yeah, so the alternative for us of not having hope is just to sit there, do nothing, and just had the feeling of like, oh, well, the world is shit anyway. Why even bother?
Right. I mean, we fall into cynicism. We fall into despair. We spend the rest of our days, you know, hedonistically trying to consume as many pleasurable things as we can before we drop dead. And that's not typically very good for feeling like you're living a fulfilling, meaningful, or happy life. Mm-hmm. And so he says that the words that he uses are, his rock is his thing.
Is his thing, you said?
His thing?
Yes. The rock is his thing. It is that by which he experiences his humanity. Through the struggle, through pushing the rock up the mountain, he experiences his humanness, his capacity to strive, his capacity to will, his strength, his body. He experiences his existence, because if he didn't, he wouldn't feel like he exists at all.
Okay.
So that it's sort of the CrossFit thing.
It seems like from what Camus is saying is that Sisyphus is choosing to do this. And that's sort of what he's using to define himself as his role in life is. And how does hope come into that?
Well, I think that this world is our thing.
Oh, okay. Yeah, and so Sisyphus, his world is just pushing this boulder up a hill every day. And he has no other way or no other option.
Right, and here we are on this big rock spinning around. And
it's going to be at the same place every day.
Here we are.
Right. And we have to start over every day. All right.
Yeah. This world is our thing. We experience our humanity through engaging, through committing to a vision, getting the rock to the top of the mountain. We commit to a vision of the future. We struggle and work and believe and strive and fall down and get back up and do it again. Because we're human beings, and we experience our humanity through doing that work.
How would hope be different than faith in this sense? It seems like you're combining hope with action, whereas faith seems to be all in your head. That's what it kind of seems like, believing without any questions or taking what you're given without questioning at all or in exploring some more. Whereas hope, if you're with this definition, you're tying it into a workout, almost building it up through actions and working to become optimistic in some sense.
Yeah. And in a way it is a kind of faith. It's a faith in the human spirit. It's a faith in, I mean, when you try to, you know, if your thing is social justice or racial justice, like, look, we got a long way to go, and it's a big mountain, right? And if you are going to go out and work for social good, and people are going to disappoint you every day, and it's going to feel like, you know, it's the world is against you, and you're going to try things, and you're going to fall on your face, and you have to do it again and again and again, and the mountain is long. I mean, to continue to do that work, that decision that, like, I am going to believe that this can get better. I'm going to act as if I can radically change the world, whether or not I can. Because the alternative is to give over to the skeptics and the cynics and despair and let everybody, you know, let the powers that be win. And if it means that I need to have a kind of, I mean, I think it is a faith. You have a faith that that vision will happen, but it's not a faith that was handed to you. It is a faith that you choose. You choose to have faith in that vision. Okay. You choose to have faith in other people. You choose to have faith in yourself.
Damn it, Danielle. So faith is such like a triggering word for myself and many other people who were coming out of religion, but you just flipped the damn thing on its head and you made it, you made faith powerful again for me. Fuck.
I'm so glad. Yeah, I think
You do this every single time. You get me all depressed and then you bring me out of this damn valley and I'm excited again. Come on. It's amazing.
Yeah, I get a pleasure out of it. I know.
Like, it sounds like faith is more of an eternal thing, internal thing, and hope is something that is also internal but is expressed through external actions.
Yeah.
So if I can choose to hope in something, and then the faith is then just becomes my own, and it's not something like exactly what you said. It's not something that was handed to me. Something that I choose and.
I think faith is really important. Yeah. I mean, I grew up as a evangelical Christian. I went to college. I became a philosopher. I got really angry about all the things my parents taught me. I left. I became an atheist, right? And was very angry about it for a while. And felt this like faith was a word that I couldn't connect to anymore. It felt like this really deep loss. And I think. I think faith is really important, and I think faith in human beings and faith that the world can, you know, that compassion and justice and truth and honesty can come to the surface. It's really important to believe in that, and you don't have to associate it with, you know, a priest at the top of the, you know, standing at the head of the church. Faith is something that you can choose to have. And I think it's really essential for acting in a hopeful life.
And I guess hope is also not only the tool, but also the only way to achieve what you're trying to achieve when you're being hopeful about something. Because if you just fall into this despair and you stop doing things, that is an absolute guarantee you will not manage to do it and it will just not happen.
Yes.
So it's not just the tool, it's also like the solution to and the future that you envision in the future. Well, that doesn't make sense, but do you know what I mean?
And I think, you know, to combine those two things, I think that like a lot of times people think faith, if I just have faith, then like I don't have to do the work, right? Because the external, the beings or the other people will save me, right? It also like happens with this like sort of, you know, positive thinking, like the secret, right? If I just like envision like a Ferrari and I put it up on my vision board and I just like really have faith that the Ferrari is coming to me, then somehow it will magically like manifest in my life. And I think that like, yeah, okay, you can believe that that's true, but if you don't take action towards getting that Ferrari, it's not really going to happen, right? That's why hope is so essentially bound up with action for me. That it is both, as you say, it is both the vision and the steps towards the vision.
And just to kind of clarify, there is a significant difference between faith and trust as well. I have a definition between the two, but you're the philosopher. Would you like to set me straight at all? Or
I don't know. I haven't really done a whole lot of like work on trust. Okay. So I don't know if I know off the top of my head. I'm curious what you think the difference is.
For me, faith is kind of like blind belief in some sense. It's like the starting, in this discussion, it almost seems like the starting seed of hope. Like, I don't really have any evidence for it, but I'm going to go for it anyways. Whereas trust has a lot of evidence behind it, previous evidence. Like, I trust my mother to be there for me because she has in the past. I don't trust my father because he's an asshole and he has broken the trust in the past before. I trust that this chair is going to hold me up because it has in the past. So in my definition, trust is tied to evidence, whereas faith is something, a blind belief.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that seems like a good differentiation to me. And I think, again, when you are doing the work, when you are doing the action of working towards the vision of the future, mm-hmm. you need to take evidence into account, right? Like you can't just like, you know, I'm just going to walk out this window and like believe that I'm not going to fall. Like you have to be rational enough about it that you are actually doing actions that will bring about the solutions that you seek, right? But committing to doing the actions towards a solution that you seek is the hopeful. It is that is the act of will that keeps the engine running.
I love it when you say will, because that's just such a powerful term. It's something that's within my control. I have this will and I'm going to go towards this vision. It's very powerful. Thank you.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's, I don't think that there is another way. I think that like part of what is so, I think so demoralizing for people who start with a certain religious faith and then lose it, is that part of the faith tradition, many faith traditions, not all, but many faith traditions come with this idea that we are just like powerless little tiny human mm-hmm. mortals. And then the power really lies up here with you know, the gods or God. And we don't have will, we don't have control, we don't have power. Instead, we have, you know, grace. And like hope that God shines grace on us, and that's all. That's the best that we can hope for. And doing anything otherwise is like blasphemous because you're trying to pretend like you're God. And I think that hope and faith, like if you want to call that God, like if you want to call that will, that belief in the human spirit God, then I think God is inside all of us. Like we are, we have the capacity to do that. It is part of actually what humans, I think, are uniquely capable of doing. We are uniquely capable of believing in a vision that is yet to be realized.
Yeah. And, you know, when I was kind of first introduced to this, it sounded like super hippie, super new agey type of talk. But the way you're presenting it, it is more powerful, and it also is including like taking evidence into account to kind of, it's not a blind hope, but it's evidence to kind of direct your future actions. And I just, this is fantastic. I love it. Mm-hmm. I've said that like so many times, but I'm like genuinely excited again.
I'm glad. I think it's, I think it is kind of the only way, you know, and as Maya said earlier, like if all of the evidence is supporting your vision, then like it feels great and you feel buoyed and whatever. And when it isn't, then you feel deflated. And this is a way of separating your capacity to believe, to act, to do, to work, from all of that. You know, it keeps you like steady, and it keeps you, I think, a better advocate for the world that you are working towards.
Got it. All right. What else? Where else should we go from here?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think I'm curious to see like what questions are, and if people feel like this is too, either as you said, new agey or too.
I'm looking through the chat, and there's been some folks who were asking questions about definitions, like where does faith come in? It sounds super, super religious, like very, very similar along the religious discussion. But I feel like we've sort of untangled that, and also given the word faith, taken it back, and instead of it being solely the jurisdiction of religion, mm-hmm. we kind of worked out the difference between hoping a feeling and more of hoping in some sense an action and a muscle and a skill. One of the questions is hope contagious? And I have experienced it to be contagious, but what about you?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think that's how Barack Obama won his presidency.
Oh yeah, that's a good point.
You know, I mean, that was his campaign. He campaigned on "Yes, we can." And I think that, you know, as you said, hope can be incredibly motivating. I mean, fear is also incredibly motivating, right? Fear, anger, intimidation, all of these things are motivating. But I think that hope is uniquely motivating in the sense of it tends to provide the most effective mental state for actually getting the work done. You know, I think that like when you act out of distress or anger or fear or a sense of scarcity, like it can be really, really effective in the sense of getting what you want. But when you act out of a sense of hope and a sense of just like belief that like I'm gonna act as if a future world is possible for me, and I'm gonna believe that I can bring it about, and I'm gonna have faith that it will come, maybe after I'm dead, maybe in 1,000 years, but you know, the moral arc of the universe is long, and as Dr. King said, it bends towards justice, and maybe it does, maybe it doesn't, but you know what, sure as hell gonna work like it does, and I'm just gonna like pretend like it does, and I'm gonna be able to be actually much more effective because I'm not doing that emotional roller coaster of like, okay, things are good. Oh, things are terrible. Oh, I can work. I can't work. I'm just going to like, you know, be in my room for a month and wake me when the election's over. You know, like it's you have this kind of steady will to do the work. And I think that that is something that like we learn well from people who have been doing really challenging social justice work and racial justice work for a long time. I think a lot of white folks right now are coming to this kind of racial inequity awakening and just being like, oh my God, it's so overwhelming. I can't, and they just kind of fall into despair and that's that. And I think there are a lot of people who are like, well, welcome to the situation on the ground. It's been like this forever, and we've been doing this work of trying to change it forever, and if it's too overwhelming for you, then like get out of the way, because that's not helpful. And and feeling despairing and stopping doing the work because you feel despairing is not being an ally. It's not being an advocate. It's not actually you know, Gandhi, be the change you want to see in the world. Like, do it.
Do it.
I love that. So first of all, I want to address my camera change. Laptop Zoom kicked me out, which is why I'm using my phone now. But yeah, I'm jumping straight to the question. So someone is asking, what if we think free will is an illusion? And I can definitely relate to this because I myself don't believe in free will. I still can relate to the talk though. So do you want to explore that concept a bit more? How can we link them two things?
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing about free will, and you know, maybe we'll do another one of these if you'll have me back. We can talk all about free will and determinism. I think my sense of it is this: like, we don't know if we have free will or not, right? And there is no test that we could take, and no empirical case I think that we could make that could definitively tell us whether or not free will exists, right? And so we can choose to believe in it or choose not to, although maybe we are determined to believe in it or determined not to, depending on how you roll with that. But I think that we often experience life as if we do have free will. So we experience our day-to-day life. We're like, we're in the lunch line and there's chocolate cake or there's like fresh fruit, and we know that maybe the fresh fruit is better for us and we feel like we should choose it, but depending on all of these unforeseen influences, our blood sugar level, the temperature in the room, our conditioning from our childhood, what we, you know, whether or not we like chocolate, all of these things, like a bazillion little factors will make it so that we will have to pick either the chocolate cake or the fruit. We could not have chosen otherwise. But the way we experience it is, I'm going to choose the chocolate cake. And so I think we don't often just say, like, the world is pushing me along and, like, I had to. Some people might, you know, blame determinism for all of their life actions, in which case, like, I think that's a larger conversation. But I think that we experience life as if we are making choices. And so in my mind, whether or not you choose to have hope as an act of will and it is actually free, or you were determined to a place to choose hope because you have been pushed along by the universe to get to a point where you feel like you are able to be hopeful in the way that I'm talking about, it doesn't really matter in my mind, because I think the experience of it is the same.
Yeah, no, I think I agree because, well, I read some Harris and that kind of made me not believe in free will, but I could still relate what you were saying about hope to my personal experience. So I don't think you need to believe that you have free will to apply the decisions, because at the end of the day, whether you call it a fully free decision or not, you still do make the choice. And whether it is determined or not, by listening to this talk, you know, it influences you to potentially be hopeful in the future. So I think that makes perfect sense. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Everyone in this room may have been determined to be here, or they may have chosen to be here, but either way, you're here and now you have this information and it will push you one way or the other, or you can choose to do with it what you will. But, like, my hope is that you will all, you know, go into the world and do good.
You know, and exactly. Honestly, if the world is deterministic, if I don't have free will, then all I kind of have are my experiences in that sense. And if I can my life can just be full of fantastic experiences, and I can make choices to, or seem to make choices to go experience more and different things, then I'm okay with that too. I will have this set of experiences. I would have lived this life according to that. So I don't see it as really having a huge impact on my daily life, whether I have free will or not. I'm still going to go after those experiences.
Yeah. And like I said, it's sort of a different issue. And I think different people experience that differently. And there are some larger sort of metaphysical frameworks around determinism that makes you feel like that, for example, like you may feel like it is determined that the world that you envision will never happen, right? Or the world that you would want to see happen will never happen. And so there really is no point in doing it. It's not even like a slim possibility. It's like absolutely will not happen, because that's just fate. And I think then you're back to Sisyphus. Like, it was Sisyphus's fate to have the boulder roll back down. But, like, he kept working anyway, because we're humans and that's what we do.
Mm-hmm. That makes perfect sense. I mean, the alternative is to despair and not do anything with your life, I guess. So, yeah.
Yeah.
So someone is asking, can you speak specifically to our current world events and examples of hope we might have?
Hmm. Well, yeah, I think I alluded to that a little bit when I was talking about, you know, people working for racial justice. I think that if you're going to work for racial justice in this country, like, you have to have hope, because it is really bad, right? And things have been, you know, racism has been built into the very structure of our society and into our legal codes, into our institutions, into our economy from its inception. And we still live in that world. And yet there are people who are working and have been working since the beginning to undo that, or to create a world in which people are treated with fairness and equality and humanity and compassion, regardless of their race. And that is a long road. Yeah. It's a really long road for us. So you have to have hope to do that work.
Yeah. So you've sort of, for me, you've redefined, and I really can get behind this new definition of hope, really kind of set a lot of new terms, or a lot of terms in a different light now. So now that I have this new definition, what kind of tips would you have to maybe start to build this muscle, start to build this skill of hope? You know, what would be my workout regimen in a sense? Like, how would I, this almost feels like starting at maybe 250 pounds, lifting these 250 pound weights, but obviously I would need to start with just maybe lifting the bar.
Right. Well, yeah. I mean, I think you can see it in all different areas of your life, right? So Maya asked about, like, okay, I wake up in the morning and like, what is my life like? And it may be that, you know, one example is, you are worried about, I don't know, the value of your house because the economy is about to collapse, right? And you're just like, I see this thing coming and I feel like it's just gonna, like, everything is gonna fall to pieces. Mm-hmm. You know, my 401k is gonna go down, or I am going to lose my job, or I'm going to, like, all of this sort of doom casting that we do when we look and see, like, the tsunami wave heading towards us. And I think I think there are a few things that you can do in between to, like, to get to the hope in a way that feels authentic, right? So one is just recognizing, like, when that's happening, to kind of put the brakes on and saying, like, oh, I am telling a story of despair right now. And understanding that it is a story of despair. It is not an unmediated truth about the world. It is a story of despair that you are telling based on the input that you're seeing, right? And so one way of putting the brake on, and this is a little mantra of mine that I suppose I'll offer, it is a quote that comes from the writer Elizabeth Gilbert, who wrote Eat, Pray, Love and Big Magic and a few other things. And, you know, she's a nice white lady, and you can think of her what you will. But I think this quote has always been really helpful to me. And the quote is, turn your face stubbornly toward the light and keep it there. And I think about it in terms of the phenomenon of heliotropism, which is the phenomenon of plants turning toward the sun. You know, you put your house plants in front of a window and they will turn towards the sunlight. And they just do that naturally. And animals do that too. And I think that this idea of turning your face stubbornly, again, there's that act of will, turn your face stubbornly toward the light and keep it there. And so that's sort of the break that I use when I find myself, like, doom casting, where it's just like, oh, the world's terrible. You know, our democracy is falling apart. The economy is going to pieces. People are being, you know, impoverished and raped and abused all over the world. Like, you can doom cast. And I see myself doing it and I say, turn your face stubbornly toward the light and keep it there. Now, I want to be very clear. This is not about putting your head in the sand and just, like, not paying attention, right? Pay attention, do it with compassion, do it with eyes open, do it, think about your sphere of concern and your sphere of influence and how much power and scale you have to make change, and be judicious about what you are paying attention to. And taking that in, being able to sort of mediate it, and yet keeping your face stubbornly towards the light, right? So see that you're doom casting, know that those realities are still going to be there, even if you don't worry about them. Know that you are still a compassionate aware, responsible person, even if you don't let yourself be taken down by worrying about them. Turn your face stubbornly toward the light. Believe that things can improve for the better. Think about what that looks like for you, and then get to work.
Hmm. Yeah, so it seems like despair is definitely it's a motivating thing to not do anything. It motivates me to not do anything at all. Whereas hope, if both of these are choices, whereas hope kind of drives me to make a difference, make a change.
Yeah, I think so. I mean,
now who said this? Turn your face stubbornly to the light.
Elizabeth Gilbert.
Okay.
Yeah, and I have on my I'm not in my home office, but I have a little note card over my desk with a little flower. It says heliotropism. Turn your face stubbornly toward the light and keep it there.
I love it. I think I'm gonna print that out too and put it somewhere. Maybe I'll put it where the sun don't shine. Well, do you have anything else you wanted to say or bring up before we move on to the next part?
I don't know. I mean, I guess just that that I understand how hard it is, and I don't want this to be an excuse to just, like, you know, get tunnel vision. Mm-hmm. But I also think that if you're going to be effective in making change, you need to filter. I remember this was like a week and a half ago. Woke up in the morning, picked up my phone, you know, and like New York Times push notifications are on my phone. And before I know it, I'm like sitting in the bathroom reading about the world. And I had this moment where I was just like, Donald Trump does not get the first 10 minutes of my day. Like, I just need to, like, not eat first thing in the morning. I should have the first 10 minutes of my day devoted to preparing myself to do my work in the world. And that means for me doing some yoga, doing some meditation, maybe, you know, part of that, like lifting weights in preparing for this is actually thinking about the world you want to see and seeing it in your mind and seeing what happens in your body and visualizing. I mean, it's, you know, it gets very like cheesy and woo, but I really do think that that kind of visualization of that, of the reality that you want to see in the world, does something to you. It lowers your stress. It lowers your concern, and it makes you so that you are actually able to think more creatively, to problem solve more effectively, to do your work more effectively. If you're not constantly worried about whether or not the work is going to be fruitful, if you just believe it will be, then you can just do the work. And I think that that believing that it will be doesn't mean that you're naive, and it doesn't mean that you are stupid, and it doesn't mean that you, you know, are not in touch with reality. It just means that you are choosing to create a world that is yet to be seen, and you're doing the work to create it. And people do that all the time. Yeah. The world changes a lot. And so why not you?
Awesome. Thank you. Thank you so, so much for sitting with us today. Recovering from Religion is a nonprofit organization whose mission it is to provide hope, healing, and support to those struggling with issues of doubt and non-belief. Hope, healing, and support is waiting for you on our website, recoveringfromreligion.org. There you can speak or chat with a trained agent who will work with you through your struggles and doubts, or to help find resources that may work for you. You can also find local Recovering from Religion support groups in your area for the long-term recovery work. Resources specifically curated for those struggling with doubts, disbelief, and trauma can also be found on the RFR website. To connect with a secular therapist in your area, go to seculartherapy.org and create an account. If you'd like to support the work that RFR does, you can donate or sign up as a volunteer on the Recovering from Religion website. It's also a big help subscribing to the RFR YouTube channel, our blog, or following us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Questions, comments, and suggestions can be emailed to us at rfrx@recoveringfromreligion.org. Thanks for tuning in, and we hope you'll be with us next time on the Recovering from Religion podcast.